This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm Michael Steele. So great to have you along on this week. There's just a lot of going on in politics that's just outright stupid. And I decided this week we weren't doing stupid. So we're going to have a little change up. I wanted to get into a deep dive conversation about our kids and our children and our communities. And I've got a brother who I'm very happy to welcome to the podcast, who I think can give us some great insights, not only through the work that he's been doing, but just give us a feel of what's going on out there in the real world, not the make-believe pretend world that we see on TV, but the stuff you and I got to deal with every day. He's Reverend Dr. Starsky Wilson, is president and CEO of the Children's Defense Fund, board chair for the National Committee for Responsive Philanthropy, and vice chair of the Forum for Theological Exploration. We'll have a whole conversation, another podcast on theology, brother. Trust me. Don't even get me started. As a former seminarian. Oh my God, yeah, we could have a good time. And I won't even drink for that conversation. So. We'll keep the wine on the altar. Prior to joining the CDF, he led the Deaconess Foundation, Ferguson's Commission, in St. John's Church, the beloved community, in St. Louis. Reverend Doc, welcome, man. It's such a real pleasure to have you here.
It is an honor to be here. Thank you so much for having me, for creating this space to talk about our children and to give me a chance to connect with one of the voices I have been able to follow and learn a lot from, especially in these changing political winds over the last number of years.
Brother, I had hair when this all began. Now look at me. You know, I had a smile and a pep in the step, and now I'm just relegated to putting alcohol in my coffee. But no, it's great to have you, and it is so much good work that you're doing, particularly in this space. There's a lot about our kids that gets lost in translation, and we hear these battles over, oh, we want our kids back in the classrooms, but we know at the end of the day what that's about. It is less about education and more about getting them the hell up out of here.
And let's get our jobs, you know, let's get back to full productivity. It's much right. more about economics than it is about their preparation or well-being. Although we know, we want to make sure that kids are safely back. There's a lot about their social development, emotional development, and of course, academic advancement that we want engaged. But I'm glad that that conversation about using children as a political tool for culture wars in some cases has turned to a more robust discussion about child well-being with the advancement of some of the things in the American Rescue Plan, the American Jobs Plan, and of course, the American Families Plan. So we're having a more robust discussion about children than we have had in public policy in a long time. And so I welcome that.
So let's bust into that a little bit, because I've got two great headlines to start. And by the way, I love the name Starsky. Just so we're clear.
Thank you very much.
You know, clearly your parents are of a certain generation that.
Yeah, it locates me very specifically, locates my birth in the mid 70s appropriately and specifically.
They're probably a fan of a particular show that we all know.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And it, you know, I'm glad it could have been Starsky, or it could have been, you know, it could have been Huggy Bear.
It could have been Huggy Bear.
I think I won.
So I just thought, you know, and I just wanted to get that out there because I had to. All right. So here, I think you will appreciate these two headlines from the Wall Street Journal. Biden's daycare plan is bad for families. From Vox, Biden's plan to make America less terrible for parents. The social safety net for American families is almost non-existent. Could that be about to change? Which of those headlines is closer to the truth?
Closer to the truth is that that the supports in the health that the child care plan is going to be good for families is much closer to the headline. We have seen, and quite frankly, you could extend the headline and say, quality early child education is good for the economies of the regions that invest in them. You can go as far as the Heckman equation and find a Nobel laureate economist who says that early investments in early child education support and create a boom for economic development within regions, in as much as they also provide for the health and well-being of children long-term. We also know in the same conversation we were just talking about getting kids in school and, you know, whether that's about the economy and getting workers back productive. We also know that when we're able to get people to care, get a quality child care for people's children, then they're able to engage in the workforce in more robust, thoughtful and productive ways. So the better headline, the more accurate headline is that Biden's child care plan is good for American families, and quite frankly, it's good for the American economy.
So the Wall Street Journal gets into it. I mean, first paragraph out of the gate, the new plan billed as an effort to help low and moderate income families would put America on a path to becoming a society where the state assumes much of the care of young children. This plan sets up, gets into daycare, it gets into a whole host of decisions and activities that have heretofore rested largely inside families, that moms and dads kind of figure out what to do and how to do. Is that a fair assessment that the state, and it's a genuine concern for a lot of conservatives like myself, is, all right, I want to be able to provide the space for government to do what it needs to do to create the safety net for families, all right? But that should be a very clearly delineated space, and they should not go beyond that. At the end of the day, we want parents raising kids. We don't want the government raising kids. We don't want government institutions having an undue influence, yada, yada, yada. This plan, the way the Biden administration is kind of rolling out, and I won't even get into the price tag for it. I don't know where you get an extra $225 billion, but okay, we spent $1.9 trillion on tax cuts. I think we can find $225 billion for our children. Yeah. So you can see I'm back and forth on this. I think a lot of Americans are concerned about the money, but know we need to be smart about spending it. Yeah. Definitely concerned about the expansion of government into family situations, but know that there are families that need help. How does CDF and others out there take something like this and make it less onerous?
I think there are a couple things, right? So I think this idea that we all have some responsibility and, quite frankly, a stake in the well-being, the holistic development of children, right? Our neighborhoods have that at stake. Whether you want to talk about the positive frame that, you know, if you're a business owner and you want One of the things you look for when you're thinking about where you're going to put your next, your second headquarters, to use the language of the new, recent conversations, you're wondering about a well-developed workforce, and you're concerned about an educated workforce. So you have an interest in the pipeline into your workforce in a particular region. So you've got an interest. On the other side, if you want to take a more negative frame, we recognize that crime is connected to poverty, and poverty and well-being are inextricably linked. So governmental supports that create whole families and reduce poverty actually create more stable communities. So we say that there's an interest on all sides, whether we're thinking conservatively, we're thinking about individual liberties and interests, or whether we're talking about economics. The other thing that we say is it's time for us to catch up. We recognize, I'm from St. Louis. The first publicly funded kindergarten was in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. The first home visitation program that Senator Kit Bond actually helped to replicate mm-hmm. a federal program was rooted in the St. Louis region, actually started in Ferguson, Missouri, which has come to be known for other things in more recent years, right? That these are things that had to be tested with public support. They are clearly innovations that came out of community, tested with public support, but then began to be expanded. But they are investments in children in a way that we know that civil society needs it. And the question I ask is, do we believe that the investment of K-12 education, publicly funded and supported by, you know, quite frankly, by housing, by taxes to homes, residential taxes, is sufficient for us to compete in this economy, this global economy? Or do we believe it is sufficient to prepare citizens to engage in this critical moment for democracy? And I think the answer is no on both fronts. I think, quite frankly, we've got to get more expansive about the fact that people need a certain base of preparation and knowledge to engage in a fulsome way in democracy. And clearly, people need more support across the board to engage in this economy. The 12th grade education is not enough. And all of these things are connected to the formation and the well-being of children, which begins in childcare, and whether they have access to quality early child education, and continues to nutrition, right? It's not just about banking of knowledge, but that increase in SNAP benefits and expansion of universal school meals, which, by the way, saves the government money to actually do it universally rather than trying to target it and fine rank it. That these things help to prepare us, prepare young people for the economy, prepare the future citizens for democracy, and make sure that we as a country stay stable and secure into our multiracial future.
So when I was Lieutenant Governor of Maryland, I had education in my portfolio, and I wanted to do a holistic review of our educational system, K through 12, and of course in our university system as well. And when I sat down and thought about it, the one thing I concluded was I wanted to look at education through the eyes of children, not through the eyes of administrators and school boards and to some degree even parents, because the kids are the ones who have to be at a bus stop at 5 a.m. To catch the bus to school and have a lunch at 10 a.m. And nothing else to eat the rest of the day. And then people are wondering why kids are you know what, crazy. by 1 o'clock, they're like bouncing off the walls, and et cetera. So what is it? Why can't we look at this through the eyes of our children? Why can't we look at caring for children through the eyes of children, as opposed to through the eyes of institutions that, quite frankly, have just mucked up the care of our kids? And look, and again, you know, my dad, I told this story recently on my podcast, so forgive me, guys, if you've heard me say this before, but I think this is fitting here because it kind of goes to what my mother told me after my dad died. And I was a young kid, and I asked her later on why she never went on public assistance. And my mom is a card-carrying hardcore to this day Democrat. So this is not, this tells you it was not a political ideology. Yeah. It was a philosophical perspective for her as a Black woman raising a child in a segregated city known as Washington, D.C. back in the 60s and 70s, that she didn't, when I asked her why she didn't get government help after my dad died, go on welfare, do government assistance programs, she said she didn't want the government to raise her child. So she had this very firm view of where the line was for her with the government, how far they could come in. Right. She may take some government cheese from time to time, which I never ate, by the way. I was like, why the hell? What is this? She bringing this block. I'm like, what the hell is that? I eating that? Anyway, that's another conversation. But so she, as a parent, was looking at how to raise me through my eyes. You know, what is going to be best for my child? What do I need for him? Why don't we do that on a larger scale, where we look at these programs and we look at these institutions through the eyes of the kids that we stick in them and that we reportedly are trying to help. I know that's a clear mission for the Children's Defense Fund.
Yeah.
You know, is to look at it through the eyes of the kids. How do you get the rest of the culture and the government to do that?
Yeah, I think proximity matters. I tell people a lot. Yeah, we had a historic election, and you know that meant we had more than 74 million people vote for the person who didn't win the presidency. Right. 8 million people vote for the person who did. But there's 74 million whole human beings out here in America who didn't get to vote at all. They're under 18, but they're the ones who are going to live with the policy implications the longest. So what you're framing is critically important. And so part of what we have taken on as a mission for now two generations of American life, led, of course, first and most eminently by Marion Wright Edelman, is this charge of seeking to be a voice for those who don't have a vote, don't have a lobbyist, don't have an interest, kind of working on their behalf in Washington and across the country in many ways. And we're really glad to be a partners with child advocates across the country to be able to be that voice, but you can only amplify voices that you listen to. So it's been very critical for us to engage in not just advocacy, but direct service work. So we've got more than 100, you know, this summer, as we think about how we get kids back ready for schools, we've got more than 100 Freedom Schools operating across the country where young people will be able to engage in social development, literacy development, and education, where they begin to learn about how they can make a difference in their home, in their families, in their neighborhoods, and in their world. And so we're listening to those voices and seeking to push them through our policy conversations. How do we do that with others? We continue to encourage people not to make policy that's not informed by voices who are most deeply affected. Mm-hmm. We continue to connect our congresspeople. Yes, we go to people on Hill. I've got more calls today with congressional leadership to talk about things like the child tax credit and some of the housing supports we need. But we also encourage people to go back into community. So some of our partners at an Automatic Benefit for Children Coalition will next week in kind of child tax credit action week in districts across the country be working to kind of share stories about the impact of the expansion of CTC and its potential impact with congressional leaders across the country. And so we've got to get people in district. We've got to get, you know, faith leaders. We've got to get young people. We've got to get mothers, quite frankly, in direct contact with legislators in their districts to share their stories of impact and tell them why it never worked to give the child tax credit one time at filing date when I got to buy groceries every month. Why that shift always made sense. So we've got to be engaging in storytelling. We've got to enroll more advocates who are willing to amplify what they have heard, not just take stuff off the shelf. I love statistics, but there should be no statistic without a story.
Right.
So we should be talking about people's everyday lives.
How do we stack up globally when it comes to the care of our children? So I'm actually gonna put the cart in front of the horse a little bit in this question, because I'm gonna come back and ask a question which probably should ask first, but I think it's more fun this way. How do we stack up globally in terms of what we're doing, not just as government, but as culture, society, for children versus our, you know, partners in Europe or Asia or elsewhere. I know, for example, how Asians view the, you know, the elderly. We yeah. don't have that same view of the elderly here in this country. So I'm sure that there may be some similar disparities in perspective as well as result-oriented programming for children. What are you finding at CDF in that regard? Yeah.
Now, a couple of things that we're finding in this moment, this is a quite prescient question. Number one, we actually see that we are educating less. So this idea in the American American Families Plan to extend public investment in education down 2 years and up 2 years, considering mm-hmm. community college on one side, early child education on another, is valuable for us in increasing the contact hours because we compare negatively on contact hours related to education with, say, our Asian partners that we're competing with, China and others that we're competing with globally. And when we talk about care, to take another comparison, the child tax credit and moving toward, again, we want to shift this language a little bit, moving toward a permanent benefit or child allowance. All English-speaking industrial nations have such a child allowance. So the CTC that we're now expanding, getting 23 million additional children engaged in it, this kind of benefit to care for children is already the case in Australia, already the case in the UK, already the case in Canada. So this is something where we're needing to catch up with what the rest of the world is doing. And of course, we've known for some time that things like the expansion of Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act have been things we've needed to do. And we still got to do in 13 states as far as expansion in Medicaid. We start talking about care and access to health insurance. And even in states that have expanded, we've seen kids dropping from the rolls by the hundreds of thousands, 100,000 in the last year in the state I came from in Missouri because of administrative changes. So we've got a lack of access to care, which is, again, a critical function that we talk about in the American Jobs Plan. So we don't compare positively in these developed nations as it relates to education, care, and especially as related to health. And so it challenges, I try to continue to make this case, it challenges a critical element of our foreign policy, which has been a lane of moral authority based upon our commitment to democracy, hearing the voices and caring for our people. So if others are caring for their people at a rate that is higher or demonstrates greater depth than us, then the question becomes, where does our moral lift come from to guide the world in the way that it needs right now, the American voice?
Yeah, you just perfectly laid out why I asked that question before moving to this part. First, because it sort of begs the question for me then, what do children need relative to what we see them getting, and how does that play itself out? You know, people, a child credit. You know, it's a credit I may get, you know, on my taxes or however it's created. But is that really what it just boils down to, is, you know, something as simple as putting in place child credits or expanding a lunch program? My sense when I look at what's happening globally is there's a much greater integration, and you touched on this, Starsky, as you started to answer this question. There's a much greater integration into other things. So it's not just we're going to make sure that these kids have a roof over their head or that they have the appropriate, you know, program and space for their care, but it's integrated into their education. It's integrated into other cultural things. So you're looking at, you're looking at it a little bit more holistically. My impression is we tend not to look at it holistically in this country. We tend to look at child care. First off, I think somewhat rightly that obviously it's a parental decision, right? It's what parents are there to do. But we know there's some messed up parents out there too, right? And there's some folks who just shouldn't be parents. But okay, but here we are. But we don't look at the integration of this system so that there is an educational component, there is a cultural component, there is historical component. We're seeing that played out now, the battle between 1776 and 1619.
1619, yeah.
You know, and how kids of color talk about and learn about their own history and culture. Yeah. We don't integrate it into healthcare. We don't integrate it into other things. Am I off base here, or how do you see that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we got to own, no matter what we do, is honor that children don't grow up in programs, children don't grow up in policies, children grow up in homes and families, right? And so part of the question is, what are the supports that families need in order to provide, to be able to even make, to your point, to be able to make the best decisions and make sure that they have the equipment to care for and create the environment for their child. So I do think that we've got to take a holistic approach. We've got to own and honor that we have never created a system for child well-being in America. We've created a system to bank knowledge from K through 12. We've created a system of what we call juvenile justice. We've created a foster and adoptive care system. We try to mitigate harm, but we have not created systems for holistic well-being. We've not looked at the whole child. So we've not thought about effectively these integration points, to your point. So I do think we need to take the best system that we've got for the most kids, which is K-12, and think about how we wrap around the supports for that integration. And we have to think about how do we provide, because that system is increasingly not, you know, people have increasing choices there. We also have to think about how we deliver directly to families supports to be able to make the best decisions. Because a lot of what you talked about has to do with access. You know, civil society institutions, including my church, made a lot of those cultural decisions available, cultural access available for me. My family vacation, I knew what the family vacation was going to be. I knew when I could tell when the family vacation was going to be. It was going to be wherever the National Baptist Convention was that year, right? We were going with the church to whatever city the National Baptist Convention was going to be in. And, you know, once every few years, we would get to drive. I grew up in Texas. We get to drive over to Florida to Disneyland twice, to Disney World twice in my growing up.
But otherwise, he were at the convention every year.
Going to the convention, going to East Texas, and every few years we might be able to go. So that being said, civil society institutions will do that work.
Yeah.
Churches and others will do that work of shaping out. But we got to make sure that the families have the basic capacity to engage them, right? This is the difference. This is the difference today. If it's the case that we don't pay a livable wage, so my mama, instead of being able to work at what was then Southwest and Bell in the daytime and volunteer with the church at night and on the weekends, if she had to take a second job, then, and let's be clear, my mother had a high school education.
Right.
And she worked in forecasting and marketing for a number of years with Southwest and Bell as it became SBC and AT&T. But she cared for us on that. And she volunteered with the Citizens Committee to Save Our Children. She was the Vacation Bible School leader, the Baptist Training Union leader, the before we had youth ministers, that seemed like an evolution.
I know, right?
Directors, it was somebody's mama, right? That was my mama. But she was able to support that institution with her volunteer time. If she has to work two jobs, which, you know, with that education, she wouldn't have been able to raise our family without two jobs, I wouldn't have had access to those cultural institutions.
Right.
But we've got to raise wages. We got to raise wages so families have the room to raise children. And as we do that, we got to provide direct supports and benefits to families to give them the relief to be able to make civic life valuable, vital, and accessible to children, so that they can get all the other things they need. right? They can actually go and play rather than being inside. I know people don't talk about latchkey kids anymore. Now kids got a computer, they don't want to go outside.
That's right. No, I'm good right here, Dad. I'm good.
But get to be healthy by running and playing outside, get to engage in after school and out of school time activities, and get to have the exposure of, you know, the cultural stimulation and access and exposure that our civic and faith related institutions give us. We actually choke that when we don't make sure families have the resources.
Right.
As we make parents work more or work in more desperation, so that they actually don't even have the energy to put into nurturing their own children.
We're talking with the Reverend Dr. Starsky Wilson, President and CEO of the Children's Defense Fund. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to drill down a little bit more on the impact that the pandemic has had on our kids. We'll be back with more right after this.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Michael Steele Podcast. We're having a great conversation, very insightful, and I think an important conversation with the Reverend Dr. Starsky Wilson, President, CEO of the Children's Defense Fund, Board Chair of the National Committee for Responsive Philanthropy, and Vice Chair of the Forum for Theological Exploration. So, Reverend Dr. Wilson, we've touched on a lot of elements that sort of go into shaping and influencing policy around kids, and certainly the impact that that has had and has continued to have on children. We are still within the grip of a global pandemic. We've seen these battles being played out now at the state level as things start to open up with the vaccine, and the age to get the vaccine has come down to 16, and there's now consideration to lower the age to 12. And of course, there's this debate around the impact on children. How have you assessed, how has the CDF assessed more directly the impact of COVID on our kids, beyond just the educational narrative that we started out talking about? Oh, kids got to go back to the classroom, and there's value to that, but we also know some of what was driving that as well. But more importantly, the psychological as well as emotional impact that this pandemic has had on children and how we may see that manifest itself over the next 10, 12, 18 months.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you first how I assess it is I look at my four kids and think about their individual needs. So this has been a unique journey for us and our family. Because I've got a 16-year-old who wanted to continue to play basketball. And so while he was virtually schooling, he was still having in-person practice and having to get tested every week during the pandemic and during the season with several scares, with access to other team, other players on other teams who caught COVID-19. So we remind people, of course, that our children are not immune from COVID-19, as we earlier tried to think. But we also recognize that they're not immune from the impacts, the psychological, the social, the mental health impacts. As mine are Black children, I also recall the CBC report from December of 2019 that suggested that coming into the pandemic and even before this, we were seeing spikes in suicide rates among Black teenagers. So we had a suicide crisis in the Black community before the pandemic that disrupted their social routine, took them away from their friends, and cloistered them around the computers that we were trying to keep them from headed into.
Trying to decrease
screen time, we increase screen time. And so we really do have to tend to the mental health impacts, the spikes that we're seeing in targeted communities, particularly Black and Brown communities, around suicide rate, death by suicide in the attempts. Because these are real indicators of what the increased concern about loss, social disconnection from not just friends, but also family, seeing themselves in the context of several generations by being able to be with grandmother, see grandmother, grandfather in ways that you've not been able to see them recently. So what we're asking people to do, consistent with the conversation we had before, is we're asking people to ask kids this question, basic question you used to ask your children, where does it hurt? Mm-hmm. As we think about going back into schools, as we think about going back into the jobs in the fall, as we test some of these opportunities during the summer and the spring, as far as in-school contact and the like, we should ask kids how this has impacted them. And that's how we're measuring it. So this summer, we'll spend time in our Freedom Schools asking with our partners, children and their parents, how has this impacted you? We're looking at the best of the research that tells us that we should be concerned by social and emotional development. And we're trying to offer additional supports for that as kids go into school. So we're going to have to be more social. We're going to have to lean in, having more conversations with children and youth. And we're going to have to respond to what they tell us. There are things that we can know. We can look out for from the research. Are they connected? Are they talking with friends? Do they want to go to the dance that is available to them in a particular semester? Or have they just recoiled and gotten used to a lack of connection? These are critical questions. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is, this is something much like the COVID-19, like the coronavirus, is something that we can't see. So the impact on children, we're going to have to monitor. We're going to have to ask them how they're feeling. I really appreciate this new research around languishing, thinking, oh, my child's not depressed, but are they languishing? That doesn't mean mm-hmm. they're thriving just because they're not depressed. And they may be seeing it. They need to be reminded to pay attention to what's happening with them. And we need to be not just looking for an impact on grades, because I'll tell you, this is, I think about my 13-year-old. This has been my concern for him. My conversation for him has been, I think school is too easy for you in the pandemic. He gets his work done so fast. He's made all A's in the pandemic. He's made all A's before.
Right.
He worked harder. He's making all A's in the pandemic. I think we do have a challenge with, whether kids are getting the kind of robust education that they were getting before.
How robust that was before, but we, I don't know, certain public inner city schools, robust is an interesting term, but it's an important one. Nonetheless, I think in light of that aspect of what you've described, particularly in the languishing part of it and how all of this psychologically impacts children, then you layer on top of that for Black children the whole reality around Breonna Taylor and George Floyd, and how do Black kids, particularly young Black men, and it sounds like you have two boys or four boys.
What are you? Three boys.
Three boys and a girl. So you're going to have three times over the 10 and 2 conversation with your sons.
Yes.
You've got a 16-year-old who's just starting to drive, probably, and going to hang out with his friends. And particularly, as I used to tell my sons, when you hang out with your white friends and you get pulled, if you get pulled over, remember the cop sees you as the most dangerous person in that car.
Yeah.
So how has that conversation, or how does that reality also figure into the psychology of our kids in this pandemic space, given all the pressures that come from that and the societal cultural pressures that existed before? And now you've got this new reality. It's not a new reality, it's old reality, just played out in a new way in respect of policing and the criminal justice system. I mean, it's just to be a 16-year-old Black boy today has got to be, you just want to curl up into a ball and stay home.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've seen it, every child is different. I've seen it happen to different ones, especially my boys who are older. They're 16, 13, and 11 in different ways. And of course, my boys also grew up with me very actively engaged, in 2014 and 15 in the Ferguson uprising. Right. So they saw me.
So they were there. Right.
Yeah. So they didn't directly, I didn't take them out to protest and those things. But, they saw pictures of me arrested. They saw me and the Ferguson Commission meetings, working and convening. So they have a sense of this. But I'll also say, to the high level, my most clear statement about this is that these elements arrest the development of Black children and brown children. Meaning, I'm clear that I have not afforded the same freedoms to my children that I was afforded based upon my concern for their well-being, so that they have not had the same opportunities for life skill development that I had at their age, based upon a sense of security and safety that they do not have the privilege to access. That's one thing. The other is, and I think that redounds across the country. And I think that's for kids who are, you know, middle class with access like mine, to kids who are in communities of deeper need. I saw that, you know, I pastored for 10 years in a distressed neighborhood in North St. Louis, where I saw the same things, that, you know, while kids had opportunities to engage back and forth on the streets, they were also restrained and their development based upon concerns about safety, right? So those are still my children. And in another way, I'll say, it has also prepared them for the realities that they're going to have to contest to have voice. Mm-hmm. So my 16-year-old, when he was then 15, was with me at the polls last year when we were, you know, engaging in the illicit activity in the state of Georgia of feeding people at the polls and giving them water in line. And, you know, he was clear.
Right.
He needed to be a part of this mass mobilization there in St. Louis to make sure that people didn't get out of line, make sure people had that opportunity to vote. He has clarity about those issues. He, you know, he pushes back. He's the one who's talking about Ibram Kendi in my house. And what he's learning about how to be an anti-racist and advancing those ideas and challenging even the notions that we have inherited,
right,
about race and racism. And so I think there's also this matter of intellectual kind of preparation and in some cases militarization that is coming from young people to, because they want democracy for them. They want what they have been sold and told is the American dream. And they see very clearly that that's not necessarily something that will redound to them without without some challenging contest. So I think there are ways from a social, emotional, and life skills standpoint it arrests development, but there are other ways in which it's causing young people to get intellectually and politically prepared.
Man, you laid out some serious thought here. It's been the work that you're doing at CDF is so important and so critical because it's touching on our future right now. You know, it is trying to create that space that these kids, you know, can move into and grow and learn and be productive and contribute. Though it's always struck me that, particularly in how folks look at Black and brown kids, that they see this 13 or 14 year old boy. And I remember visiting our prison system in Baltimore at the time, housing 13, 14, 15 year old young men. And I look at them and I tell them, this isn't your future. And don't let anyone tell you it is. Yeah, you made a mistake and you're paying your debt to society, but don't think this is the trap that you're going to fall into and you're going to be here forever. And yet outside of those walls and outside of my they're hearing my words, they don't have a reinforcement of that, which is why the work you're doing is so important to reinforce for these folks that, for these young people, that the course they're on, while rugged and tough at times, is not definitional, that they ultimately get to define that, and trying to get adults to appreciate that and help them get it right is hard work. And you're doing the hard work, Reverend Dr. Starsky Wilson. I appreciate you coming on and sharing some thoughts. There's a whole lot more that I could get into with you about the work around children, because I don't think America appreciate kids the way we see others around the globe, and sort of looking at putting in place those foundations. In some sense, it's very transactional. How we approach our children, and that's very unfortunate. But that's why you're there, sir.
I'm glad to be here, and glad to be in an ongoing conversation. Like I said, I'm glad that we're having this dialogue now in the American kind of public space. Right. But I'm also, there's much more to talk about. We got much more work to do, and I'm glad to be partnering with folks like you to lift it up.
Well, I'm glad I could be a part of the conversation with you. And please, as your work continues, if there's anything that, I can do and we can certainly do on this platform, don't hesitate to reach out to help elevate. For me, when it comes to kids, it's not partisan. It's personal. It's how we treat ourselves is often reflected, in how we treat children, how we view ourselves is how we treat children. So thank you for your good work. Dr. Starsky Wilson, President, CEO of the Children's Defense Fund, and just really appreciate your insights in your conversation.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
All right. So, folks, that does it for this time together. You know how much I love you when you do that download thing, because you're showing the brother some love, and we like that. Don't forget to go to, Stitcher, Apple, TuneIn, all those fun places to do the download stuff. Also, real quick, where can they follow the work you're doing with the CDF? Give us the website.
Yeah, absolutely. You can find our work at childrensdefense.org. You can follow on Twitter at Child Defender, Instagram, Child Defender 1973. And you can follow me at Rev Dr. Starsky.
Excellent. Let's do that, folks. Let's give Rev Dr. Starsky a helping hand from time to time, and check out the work that they're doing at CDF. Until next time, be safe, folks. Take care of yourselves, and show your love for others by getting vaccinated. Okay, just do that. All right, you love your mama, right? You love your grandmama. Get vaccinated. I understand how you feel about your kids, right? But especially after having them locked up in the house with you for a year, I understand. But get vaccinated anyway. All right. Until next time, peace out.
I'm sports psychologist Dr. Andrew Jacobs. I created the Sportsmanship Foundation to promote and educate parents and athletes about the role of good sportsmanship in our development. Learn more at winnersunlimited.com. That's winnersunlimited.com.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to lostgolfballs.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands, in stock, 50% off retail. LostGolfBalls.com.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQBar plant protein bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQBars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.